Hello, and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Mike Coons. He's USU Extension Forestry Specialist, and we hope that you'll join our conversation. We're going to be talking about trees, and our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and send your question there. Thanks for coming in, Mike.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, you're also a new department head.
Yeah. That's, I think, 75% of my job, and 25% of my job is being extension forester. But then there's other people who I work with doing extension forestry as well.
And this is in the College of Natural Resources?
Uh-huh. Yeah, the Quinney College of Natural Resources, and our department's called the Wildland Resources Department. So even though I do a lot of urban forestry, I'm in a wildland department. And we have forestry, range, and wildlife in the department.
Well, I wanted to start out our conversation asking you about a bill that's wending its way through the Utah legislature. And this bill was inspired by some children in a, I want to say Milford, but I can't remember where in
somewhere southwest.
Yeah. And to change the state tree from, right now it's the Colorado blue spruce, to the quaking aspen. Now, I've lived in Utah most of my life, and I've often wondered, why do we have the state tree be the Colorado blue spruce, along with the state bird being the California gull? Why can't we come up with something of our own?
Right.
So as I looked at quaking aspen, there's not a state that has the quaking aspen as its state tree. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's only one province in Canada, and that's in the Yukon. And so I thought, okay, well, maybe this is a good candidate, but I also thought, well, why not something like Rocky Mountain maple? Right. So why don't you talk about how, and you're not going to be advocating for this one way or the other, but just talk about why quaking aspen is an indicator species for Utah and an important species.
Yeah, well, for our forests, it's probably our number one tree species by acreage. And it's very important for wildlife of many sorts. Elk and deer eat them, as well as sheep and I don't know if cattle do. I suppose they browse on young aspens. It's just a very important species up in our higher elevation forests. I don't know if we have more aspen or if we have more juniper, but we certainly have plenty of aspen. The Rocky Mountain, or the Colorado blue spruce, the California gull, if you think as a scientist does and you think in terms of Latin names and taxonomical descriptions and such, the Colorado is just a word somebody put on it. We can call it blue spruce, and we could call it Utah blue spruce. So that wouldn't be a reason to change. And the California gull would be the same way. There's some Latin name for it that has nothing to do with California. But blue spruce isn't really common in our forests, whereas if we were going to pick a spruce, we should pick Engelmann spruce because it's by far our most common spruce. But aspen's important. Blue spruce is fine. Blue spruce is a better tree down in our landscapes in our towns and cities, although it has problems too. Certainly aspen is not a species we promote a lot for planting in towns and cities.
Well, that was one of our wait, don't plant that segments where we talked about don't plant an aspen, just basically admire it.
Yeah.
In the mountains.
I do have a way if people want to grow aspens in their yards to live better with some of its bad habits, basically growing it in small groves, letting sprouts come up, and cutting out most of the sprouts and letting just a few develop. never let one get bigger than you could remove in an hour, you know, with a handsaw. And but the problem is you're going to have sprouts everywhere in your yard if you do that, and your neighbors will have sprouts too. But it eases the problems that the species has with borers in the stem, especially because you never let one get big enough that the borers are a problem.
So never get them any larger than what, about an inch in diameter, and just keep do like renewal pruning sort of?
You could do that. I might even let them go up to 5 or 6 inches in diameter, and have just a couple of those in a grove along with some smaller sprouts that are going to come up to take over for those bigger ones when you remove them.
I've looked at the aspen, and you know, you go up into the mountains, you love having them. You see that quaky feeling when there's even a slight rustling of the wind. So aesthetically, they're quite pleasing.
Yeah.
But as far as how they're an indicator species for everything else, I know in the news the last couple of years, there's been reports of decline in aspens. And can you talk about that a little bit?
I think that's maybe overblown a little bit.
Really?
Yeah, especially from a statewide standpoint. We've lost probably most of the aspen acreage we've lost is due to conifers that are more certain conifers are more shade tolerant. Aspens aren't shade tolerant at all. So their own sprouts don't even grow well under the shade of the bigger trees. But we get spruces and firs seeding in under the aspens. They can tolerate the shade of the aspen. Then they grow up through it. The aspens fade away, and you end up with a conifer forest. And the way you would set that back and get back to aspen is letting fire burn. But we're just not very
suppression.
Good. Yeah, we're not very good societally at letting fires burn, you know. Because anytime a forest manager lets a fire burn, if it gets out of control, they're in trouble, you know. So if we're not going to let fires burn, then we have to disturb the forest manually to be able to set succession back, succession going from aspen to shade-tolerant conifers. We can go and clear-cut it while there's still aspens there, and the aspens will sprout up from their root systems, and we've got a new aspen forest. There was some talk of sudden aspen death.
Yes.
And that's what I think maybe is a little overblown. It may have occurred in some places, but nobody's really shown that there's a pathogen or something. I think there's a bark beetle that's been showing up in aspen that's a natural pest that doesn't normally get too bad. Certainly animals can hurt aspen stands if you have too many elk, too many deer, too many sheep, especially at the wrong times of the year, then you can lose aspen to those creatures as well.
So why do you think there is this push? Is it because of the name Colorado, even though it doesn't mean a whole lot?
Yeah, I think that's what it is. But it's a good civic exercise for the kids, and I think it doesn't matter a whole lot to the state if that succeeds or fails. If we stick with Colorado blue spruce, though, we can just decide. Maybe they can do a proclamation that Colorado blue or Picea pungens, which is the native or the Latin term, we can just declare that that is called Utah blue spruce when it's planted in Utah.
So are there any trees that can be grown pretty much anywhere in the state that would make a better candidate? And you're not going to say, okay, well, that should be this one, but I'm just wondering.
The most ubiquitous species, if you're talking high elevation, then aspen is it, I think, because it ranges pretty far up and down in elevation, but it doesn't get down into the valleys because there isn't enough precipitation. Junipers get lower in elevation just above our towns and cities. Often some of our towns are within juniper. So Utah juniper and Rocky Mountain juniper would be good choices from that standpoint. And the junipers do go up in elevation a fair distance too. But there's no tree, there's just no species that can survive at the low elevations where most of us live without irrigation. So all our trees in our towns and cities, if our towns and cities are below about 4,500 feet, we planted the trees. The exception would be along rivers where you'd have cottonwoods. So, you know, another choice would be Fremont cottonwood. It's almost everywhere along rivers, although it doesn't get really high in elevation, but they're majestic trees.
And they're native.
They're native, yeah. And we don't have the word Colorado there. We have Fremont. but aspen's a very important species, so I wouldn't be disappointed if it goes that way. But I think originally it probably was just the name Colorado that seemed funny to some people.
Well, I thought about that for the gull. You know, it's like it's the same thing. It's just the word California is in it. It says, well, why couldn't it be a Bonaparte gull or a Franklin gull or something without California? But
actually, when I take groups of kids and even adults out, but especially kids, if we're doing some tree ID, I'll encourage them initially to give a tree a name, their own name, because common names are just made up and they have no basis in taxonomy, which is how we organize plants into species, genera, families, and orders, and on up. There's really no basis. Osage orange, you and I were just talking about. It's not an orange, but it was called that because the fruit kind of looks like a green orange, and but it's not an orange, and that's just a common name somebody gave it. And the real name is Maclura palmifera, and that's why botanists and scientists are constantly using Latin names, because there's only one Latin name for each species. Douglas fir, one of our most common big conifers that a lot of lumber comes from, especially from the Northwest. We have Douglas fir here. It's not a fir. The name is hyphenated, Douglas hyphen fir, and usually that indicates it's not a true whatever you're saying. So it's not a fir. It's the genus Pseudosuga, and the firs are the genus Abies. What else was I going to say?
So what is it?
It's Pseudosuga. It's its own genus. There's only a few species in that genus. But it's also called red pine in Utah.
You're kidding.
And red fir. I called a sawmill, or a sawmill called me, one in the Uinta Basin when I first got here 20 years ago. And there are no sawmills left in the Uinta Basin, but they called me wanting to learn about drying red fir. And I had to think fast, and I knew that Douglas fir has a almost red heartwood. And I thought, I'll bet he's talking about Douglas fir. And I couldn't just type on the internet at the time and learn what I needed to quickly. But it turned out, that was a common name for lumber people for Douglas fir.
So it sounds like if it's not pine or fir or spruce, I mean, it's like we've created these very limiting categories, and so, well, it feels like a fir, so we'll call it a fir.
Feels like or looks like, non-experts tend to, in taxonomy, you know, the organization of creatures, we tend to have people who are lumpers and people who are splitters. Some people want to combine species that seem very close to one another into one species, or maybe combine genera, not thinking right now of where an example of where two genera, that's the plural of genus, have been combined recently, but there's lumpers and splitters, and the public tends to be lumpers to the extreme. An example is people tend to think, like, use the word conifer to mean almost all evergreens, mm-hmm. or they use the word pine to mean almost all evergreens, or the word spruce to mean almost all evergreens, because they haven't had the time and maybe the willingness to learn the fine points of why a Douglas fir is different from a true fir, and what makes it different. But scientists do get into splitting things quite a bit because they know the two species won't interbreed, for example. In some cases, that's used. If they commonly, this tree can pollinate that tree, then they may be the same species.
Well, I'm thinking about birds at this point, where this happens all the time. And one of them is an oriole that, and I'm hoping I'm not getting this backwards, that used to be a separate species, but then got combined into northern oriole and subspecies, but now they're split apart again. So,
So even within scientists and taxonomists, things ebb and flow. Sometimes things will get split apart, and then somebody else proves that they're really genetically identical, except for some minor little thing that affects their color or something. And then they'll put them back together. When I went to school, incense cedar, which is a somewhat common landscape tree in the Wasatch Front, really great tree, was called Libocedrus decurrens. That was its Latin name. Now it's called Calocedrus decurrens. So that wasn't even a matter of lumping or splitting. It was a matter of Calocedrus, I think, literally would maybe mean beautiful cedar. Libocedrus, I'm not sure what that meant. But somebody thought Calocedrus was the proper way to name that, and they won.
Well, how do you find out about these changes?
One way I found out was I wrote that Trees of Utah book and put it out there, and then had people point out to me that some things were changing. And I think that's where I found out first about Calocedrus. I don't read a lot in the taxonomic literature, so I don't really find out too much that way. But just occasionally hearing somebody refer to something with a different name than I thought. Another example is bristlecone pine. So it's a pine, Pinus genus. And the name for all bristlecone pines when I was in school was Pinus aristata. And now it's been split, and there's Pinus aristata, which I think is maybe the eastern populations of bristlecone, and then there's Pinus longaeva, and that's the western populations of bristlecone.
So they just and we're part of the western.
I think we're part of the eastern.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and which one's longaeva and which one's aristata, I'm not remembering right now.
So someone just found a genetic difference between the two populations
that they felt was enough of a difference to call them two different species. Yes.
Is it likely that they used to be one species, and then as the Nevada desert started stretching apart and genetically just changed from each other?
Yeah, that could be. There's some people that think that you said Rocky Mountain maple earlier, and I think you probably meant big tooth maple.
Sorry,
that's
yes, I did.
Our one that turns orange. And some people think that used to be Acer saccharum, which is sugar maple. Which, is the sugar maple from the Lake States and the northeastern U.S.
And by the way, don't grow them here.
Well,
sugar maples.
There's a sugar maple, I think, right outside the personnel office, right next door.
A sugar maple?
Yeah, that gets great fall color. There's some at the bottom of the Temple Hill in Logan, along the street there, that are doing okay.
Down, didn't they?
Sugar maple is better than for our climate a little bit than red maple, Acer rubrum.
Well, I thought there was an issue with sugar maple with the pH of the soil.
There is, but it's not as bad as with red maple, Acer rubrum. But anyway, people think maybe the Rockies lifted up and separated what was Acer saccharum all over the place, or what we would have called Acer saccharum, and then the Western stuff, you know, evolved over much time and became a fair amount different than Acer saccharum. Now we call it Acer grande dentatum out here, the big tooth maple, and that's the maple we're kind of famous for, this part of the Rockies.
That's usually the orange and the reds,
yeah,
that we'll see in the fall.
Yeah, pretty reliably orange.
You're listening to Zesty Garden. Mike Coons, USU Extension Forestry Specialist, is my guest for the rest of the hour. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Or you can go to the UPR Facebook page and post your comment there, or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and we're going to get to it here in just a little bit, is the tree browser. Mm-hmm. I put a link to the tree browser on the UPR page, homepage. Good. Under Zesty Garden. So if anyone's mm-hmm. interested, you can click on that link. I've also got a link to pruning landscape trees and overview, which is what we'll be talking about in the second half of the program. Okay. So if anyone would like to pick up a USU tree browser, I do have you have to have a drive that reads a CD, but I do have this available that I'll send out to you if you don't happen to have a computer access or something. And I've got one of these left. I found it in the premium closet.
So yeah, you'd have to have a computer, but you wouldn't have to have internet access.
And internet access, exactly.
That's the first version we had.
This is a CD-ROM mm-hmm. that has all different kinds of trees on it, and I'll hand that out to the next person that calls in and asks a question. 800-826-1495, or send us an email question, zestygarden@gmail.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Hello and welcome back to the second half of the program. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me in the studio today is Mike Coons, USU Extension Forestry Specialist, and we're talking about trees. And winter is a great time to do pruning. Mm-hmm. So let's launch into it and talk about why that is so.
Yeah, I think the main thing with pruning in winter is that the wound you make, which unless you prune off a dead branch and only cut in the dead wood, you're making a wound when you prune. And the wound will start to heal immediately when growth starts in the spring. The edges of the wound where you've cut the bark and cut the cambium, which is the slick layer right at the base of the bark where it meets the wood, growth will start there. It's called wound wood or callus, and a ring of wood will start to form around that wound and eventually close it over. And that's going to start right away as soon as spring comes. And if you do it earlier in the winter, it's just going to sit there waiting for spring. But there aren't a lot of pathogen spores, you know, like fungal spores floating around in the winter outside to infect a wound. And even if they did get to a wound, it's cold, so there's really – they won't grow, you know.
The tree's inactive.
Yeah, the tree's inactive. And spring's a little dicey because the bark gets a little loose and you can maybe a little more easily tear the bark. when you're removing a heavy limb.
Plus, you don't have the insect problem of them trying to get in through that open.
Yeah,
room.
There aren't a lot of insects out there. Although most insects that get into trees, bark is no doesn't stop them. And then fall is a little bit bad because there's maybe a little more likelihood of the wound getting infected. But really, if you're a procrastinator, you should prune at any time of the year that you get the time. You know, you don't want to put off, let's say you got a limb 3 feet off the ground that you know is not going to be there forever, that you're not going to put up with that limb being there in your way. Well, you want to leave it on when it's young, when it's contributing a lot to the food making capacity of the tree, but you don't want to leave it on so long that you're going to be making a really large wound when you cut it. So if you're going to remove a limb eventually, but to maybe raise the crown of the tree up, then you should try to make the cut when the wound is maybe 2 inches diameter, no more than that, to keep from making a really large wound.
That's kind of where I am with a horse chestnut that I have, a Fort McNair horse chestnut. I love it because it has these beautiful pink blossoms. And whenever anybody comes over to the house during the month that it's kind of in blossom, 3 weeks or so, they're just like, oh, what kind of tree is that?
Yeah.
But now I say I planted it when my daughter was 8 and she's now 19. Mm-hmm. So it's gotten to the point where I've been started gradually raising those lower branches.
Yeah.
so we can get around it. And there may be the biggest ones are maybe an inch and a half.
Yeah,
in diameter, and it's a lot easier to take care of them because you can actually hold the branch while you're doing the cutting,
right?
Rather than having to do an undercut and then another cut on larger branches,
right? And that wound is small enough that it'll cover over.
Oh, quickly,
heal quickly, yeah. Trees. Sometimes people talk about tree experts talk about trees don't heal; they seal, because the wound is there inside once it gets covered up. And it doesn't matter in most cases. When we see a knot in a board, well, that was a branch that probably eventually got cut off or fell off and then got covered over often by the tree, although sometimes they go right out to the edge of the log. The wound is still there inside the tree. Where it matters is with really big wounds. If you make really big pruning cuts, you know, you're pruning off a 6 or 8 or 10 inch diameter limb, it may eventually get covered over, but you'll have some pretty major defects inside that trunk that can actually cause things like what we'll call it. It'll heal and you won't even maybe know that it was there at one time, and then a crack will show up. Mm. And people will call it a frost crack. But in reality, it may be shrinking and swelling or flexing of the tissues inside based on the damage that wound did to the tree that's been covered up and now has reappeared. So small wounds, try to make all your cuts before a branch gets bigger than about 2 inches in diameter.
I think a good example of what not to do is a green ash that we have at our home. It's a large tree. It's an old one. It's been there for a while, and it shades our house. We don't want to get rid of it. But on the west side, there is a place that someone cut a branch off that's probably a foot in diameter,
mm-hmm.
and it has now it's gradually closing over, but there's going to be a hole. There's a hole in the hearthwood. I can stick my hand in it.
Oh, so
and it's been there a long time, but it's gradually closing over. But you know, if I were to let that tree get too tall, I've got some serious issues as far as things breaking off.
Yeah, but one thing trees are good at is some trees, not cottonwoods and willows and aspens, they're not good at this, but ashes would be good at it, and that's kind of sequestering decay, and it stays inside the tree, and often you'll get a column of wood, the wood that was there in the year when the wound was made often will decay away, or maybe a pie-shaped piece will decay, and it may go well up and down the tree, and you'll end up with a cavity inside the tree. But the new wood that's put on from the year that wound was made and later gets chemicals put down in it, in the xylem itself, that protect it from decay. And so you can end up with essentially a pipe of wood, you know, a hollow cylinder, and that's a very strong structure. The only problem is if you get lots of later wounds into that intact wooden cylinder, then you're starting to break down its strength again. But just having a cavity inside a tree isn't necessarily a bad thing. I was a surveyor one summer and I was walking through to get a shot with our transit. You need a line of sight. And there was a black walnut tree I walked under that had big limbs coming sideways from a very big trunk. And I hit a dead branch with my machete, and it broke off right where it meets the live branch. And it just spewed dark brown water all over me. It actually made a sound, you know, as it came out. And,
building up a little pressure there for
a while. Yeah, and that was a cavity that was inside the trunk of the tree and also had made its way out into the bigger limbs. And probably somewhere way up on the tree there was a crack, and storm water would drain into the cavity. So it was probably full of that well above where I hit that branch, and it just taught me a lesson.
Well, it almost sounds like you lanced the boil.
Yeah, right. Well, but the water is not a bad thing in a tree. So trees have the ability to kind of have those wounds be cut off from the rest of the tree, but they're there inside. And let's see. So dead branches, as long as you cut outside any live tissue that has started to form at the base of the dead branch, then you're not making a wound because you're not cutting any live wood, any live tissue at all.
And those are no-brainers. Take off the dead wood.
Take off all you want, and if it's big enough to be hazardous, then you should take it off.
And we are talking about landscape trees because dead wood does provide something in the wild, but you don't want to have branches dropping on you in your landscape.
Right.
So let's talk about a more mature tree that you're going to have to do a little more cutting. You don't want to just cut the branch and then allow the weight of the limb to peel off the bark. Not good.
So, yeah, you're talking about what typically would be a three-part cut. If you're cutting a branch big enough in diameter that let's say you just made one vertical cut in the right place just outside the branch collar, you cut just outside any swollen base to the branch where the swelling goes down to a
And you can see that on the top, the collar on the top, and then the ridge
branch bark ridge on the bottom top. And the collar
okay, you got it
kinda
backwards.
All around really. And you just cut right outside that. And if it's so much weight that as you would finish that cut, it would start to tear and maybe take the bark down below where you would have cut and wound the trunk, then the best way to handle it is to go out some place convenient where you're still not – you're going to get rid of most of the weight – and make an undercut.
Seem like be a foot out or even further
than
that.
Yeah, a foot, or it could be a little farther.
Okay.
You don't want to do this multiple times, but three cuts is what it's going to take. You don't want to do a three-part cut and then have so much weight left you have to do another three-part cut. But you make an undercut and you stop before the branch would start to close that cut and pinch your saw, and that's an art. You just have to know when that is, but maybe a third of the way up through the branch. And that's going to be, you've made that cut to stop any tearing. And then you make your second cut either right down into that or beyond it. And if you make it beyond it, you don't want to be very far beyond, or as you cut down through and as it starts to break, it'll actually tear past the undercut you made. And you have to be a little bit quick when you do these cuts, too, to get it to break correctly. But the idea then is it'll break and it may be a little ragged, but then your final cut will be that cut just outside the branch bark ridge and the branch collar. And then if you cut into that undercut straight down into it, you have to be quick, but you can actually make the branch kind of pop out because as you finish that cut and that undercut you make closes, it kind of pushes the bark out. If you cut beyond your undercut, you often end up with a hinge there, and you can hinge the branch down around to avoid maybe a shrub that's next to it that you don't want to have the branch land on. I wouldn't count on these techniques working if you're trying to avoid your car or your little kid, but they can work to help you place the branch as it falls. But then you make that final cut. That's the third cut.
And don't leave a stump. Don't leave a stump, or don't cut into that collar, because then, you know, one's too close, the other one's too far out.
Yeah. If you're uncertain, leave a little more on, because you can always cut more off later. But avoid flush cuts, because you can't put any back on. and so, don't leave a stub. Stubs tend to get sprouts forming on them because of how the hormones of the tree work, the growth regulators. They also tend to get decayed, and so they just don't heal very well. And that's why you don't top trees either, where you just go and hedge the whole top, because that's nothing but a lot of stubs. So you want to go back to where a branch meets another branch, at least a third the diameter of the one you're taking. And so if you're cutting off a 6-inch diameter branch, you want at least a 2-inch diameter piece that you're leaving. Bigger is better. And then cut outside the branch collar where those two meet.
So if you need to get up into the upper part of the tree, and you talk about not just cutting off the top of the tree, no, would you just take you've got one branch going off to the left, and then there's another branch. You've got one main branch coming up, and then it splits. One goes off to the left, and the other one goes straight up. If you want to take the one that's straight up, you just cut it right where it forks out.
Yeah, and you're not going to have – if you're cutting off the bigger branch and leaving the smaller branch, which is really probably what you've described, then you're not going to have a swelling at the base of that smaller or bigger piece that you're taking off. The swelling is going to be at the base of the branch you're leaving, but you just make a sloping cut from the other side of the branch bark ridge, and – there's a diagram in that pruning fact sheet that you mentioned that shows where to make. That's called a cut on a codominant stem, where you may even be cutting off the larger stem and leaving the smaller.
Yeah, these are really good diagrams, because it shows where the branch bark collar is, where the ridge is, where to do your first cut, you know, and so on and so forth. So I have a link to this at Utah Public Radio's website. Just click on programs and go to Zesty Garden. You'll find the link for that, as well as the tree browser, so you can find some different trees to grow in your own landscape. Also, in the last couple of minutes, let's talk about your pruners. And I can't say
enough. The tools
themselves. I can't say enough how spending a little bit of extra money is completely worth it.
Yeah. You want very sharp tools, and typically you want saw blades that actually are a little thicker at the tooth edge of the blade than they are at the back edge, because those are less likely to bind in the cut. You want a stiff blade that's they're double sharpened to where they cut both pulling and pushing, but actually the teeth angle back a little bit toward you, so most of the cutting happens as you pull rather than as you push, and therefore the blade is under tension when you're cutting, and it's not going to wobble in the cut like hand saws do when you're cutting a 2x4, and you're doing all the cutting when you push. Instead, the cutting's mostly happening when you pull. There are a number of good brands, and they tend to copy one another. There's kind of an ultimate brand and then less expensive brands that have the same shape of handle, and now they even have the same color handles. They're pretty expensive. I do almost all of my pruning with a folding 8-inch, maybe even 7-inch blade, and I can cut off a 5 or 6-inch branch pretty easily with that.
I use mine, the same one, fold out all over the place. Well, we've reached the end of our time. Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Zesty Garden. We've had Mike Koons, USU's Extension Forestry Specialist, and we hope you'll stay tuned because we have now Helen Cannon with Petals and Pros and what we're calling purloined petals.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Pros. I had planned to continue talking a little bit about roses, but I got sidetracked by a clipping that I read in the paper, and then I was lured by orchids, as people who deal with orchids would understand. The epigraph to Orchid Fever by Eric Hansen says you can get off alcohol, drugs, women, food, and cars, but if you're hooked on orchids, you're finished. You never get off orchids, never. So that may be where I am. The clipping that I read is not about orchids, but about a tiny water lily. In crime that will shock the green-fingered, a thief has made off with a tiny water lily, one of the rarest plants in the world from a botanical gardens in London. The plant, of which only a handful of specimens still exist in the wild, was stolen from a lily pond at the famed Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew, the police said. The thief is thought to have dug or pulled it from the damp, temperature-controlled mud it needs to survive. Kew Gardens is one of the only places in the world to cultivate this plant, and there were only 30 plants on display, London's Metropolitan Police said. They cite its value as priceless because of its rarity. The stolen plant may have been easier to sneak out of the Botanic Garden, which has its own security because of its small size. The plant's bright green lily pads can measure less than half an inch across, and its white flower with yellow stamen is barely bigger than a fingernail. The Nymphaea was discovered in 1987 by a German botanist, Eberhard Fischer, at a thermal freshwater spring in Rwanda, the only known location in the wild. However, overexploitation of this hot spring meant the fragile habitat dried up and the water lily dried out there in about 2008. It was brought back from the brink of extinction only by the efforts at Bonn Botanic Garden in Germany, where a number of living examples had been taken, and the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew, which succeeded in propagating the delicate plant in 2009. After a number of failed attempts, horticulturalist Carlos Magdalena at Kew cracked the technique needed to persuade the water lily to grow from the remaining precious seeds. He realized that unlike all other water lilies, the Nymphaea grows in warm mud rather than water, and so found a way to replicate its native habitat using pots of damp loam surrounded by water kept at precisely 25 degrees Celsius, 77 degrees Fahrenheit, just as had occurred by the thermal spring Only then did the seedlings flourish and develop into adult plants. According to Q, for a couple of years, the only living examples of the water lily were found in Bonn and London. Now a few plants are again found in the wild in Rwanda. Richard Bailey, director of horticulture at Kew Gardens, said the police had been called after the theft was discovered Thursday. The staff is dedicated to the conservation of plants, and when incidents of this nature occur, it's a blow to morale, he said. We take our theft, the theft of our invaluable scientific collection of plants, very seriously. According to Kew Gardens website, the plant has no common name because of its scarcity, but it has become known unofficially as the pygmy Rwandan water lily. It has always been so rare that no uses have ever been known, it adds. Other instances of theft have occurred, but they are isolated and infrequent, Kew Gardens said. So I turned to thinking about the theft of plants, and of course the first book that came to my mind was by Susan Orlean, called The Orchid Thief. I had read her feature in the New Yorker magazine by the same name, and then she developed it in great detail in the book, The Orchid Thief. She begins, John LaRoche is a tall guy, skinny as a stick, pale-eyed, slouch-shouldered, and sharply handsome, in spite of the fact that he's missing all of his front teeth. He has the posture of al dente spaghetti and the nervous intensity of someone who plays a lot of video games. LaRoche is 36 years old. Until recently, he was employed by the Seminole tribe of Florida, setting up a plant nursery and an orchid propagation laboratory on the tribe's reservation in Hollywood, Florida. It's illegal in Florida to take any orchids at all, except that the Seminole Native American tribe are not subject to this ruling, and so they can take orchids and do with them what they will. I met John LaRoche for the first time a few years ago in the Collier County Courthouse in Naples, Florida. I was in Florida at the time because I had read a newspaper article reporting that a white man, LaRoche, and three Seminole men had been arrested with rare orchids they had stolen out of a Florida swamp. And I wanted to know more about the incident. The newspaper story was short but alluring. It described the wild swamp near Naples, filled with exceptional plants and trees, including some that grow nowhere else in the world. All wild orchids are now considered endangered, and it is illegal to take them out of the woods anywhere, particularly out of state property. She continues, and I'm skipping a lot in her book. She was particularly interested in finding the ghost orchid. If the ghost orchid was really only a phantom, it was still such a bewitching one that it could seduce people to pursue it year after year and mile after miserable mile. If it was a real flower, I wanted to keep coming back to Florida until I could see one. The reason was not that I love orchids. I don't even especially like orchids. What I wanted to see was this thing that people were drawn to in such a singular and powerful way. Everyone I was meeting connected to the orchid poaching had circled their lives around some great desire. LaRoche had his crazy inspiration, and orchid lovers had their intense devotion to their flowers, and Seminoles had their burning dedication to their history and culture. It was a religion. I wanted something as much as people wanted these plants, but it isn't part of my constitution. I think people my age are embarrassed by too much enthusiasm. I had seen nothing but bare roots, I said as I talked with LaRoche on the phone. I was wondering whether I had missed this year's flowers or whether perhaps the only place the ghost orchid bloomed was in the imagination of people who'd walked too long in the swamp. What I didn't say was that strong feelings always make me skeptical at first. What else I didn't say was that his life seemed to be filled with things that were just like the ghost orchid. Wonderful to imagine and easy to fall in love with, but a little fantastic and fleeting and out of reach. I could hear the soft, puckery gulp as he inhaled cigarette smoke. Then he said, expletive JC, of course, there are ghost orchids out there. I've stolen them. I know exactly where they are. The phone was silent for a moment, and then he cleared his throat and said, you should have gone with me. The Orchidaceae is a large, ancient family of perennial plants with one fertile stamen and a three-petaled flower. One petal is unlike the other two. In most orchid species, the petal is enlarged into a pouch or lip and is the most conspicuous part of the flower. There are more than 30,000 known orchid species, and there may be thousands more that haven't yet been discovered, and maybe thousands that once lived on Earth that are now extinct. Humans have created another 100,000 hybrids by cross-fertilizing one species with another, or by crossing different hybrids to one another in plant breeding labs. Orchids are considered the most highly evolved flowering plants on Earth. They are unusual in form, uncommonly beautiful in color, and often powerfully fragrant, intricate in structure, and different from any other family of plants. The reason for their unusualness has always been puzzled over. One guess is that orchids might have evolved in soil which was naturally irradiated by a meteor or mineral deposit, and that radiation is what mutated them into thousands of amazing forms. Well, I will continue with you the next time I have the opportunity to speak to you about Petals and Prose. Thank you for listening. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.